like a god with a six-figure devil's head. Blood money's the only money there really is. Whether you bang on the block or board rooms for billions, it's a spectacular terrorist event. Nuclear the medicine man. Smack a god with a six-figure devil's head. Blood money's the only money there really is. Whether you bang on the block or board rooms for billions. Right, so Mario from Symbolic Studies, this I've been watching your channel for a while now, and I just want to say to you, your channel, I know that you come from a graphic designer background, which I think really lends itself to YouTubing in general, or anything like that, creative arts in general. And your channel has such a beautiful, I'm not trying to blow smoke up your ass, but it's a really elegant, really tight, really beautiful looking YouTube channel. It's not like some of them could be quite heavy when I go there and I'm like, oh, you know, I don't want to watch this shit. You know, this seems a bit, you know, over the top, but yours is just, yes, mwah, perfect.
Yeah, excellent, man. Excellent. Thanks for telling me that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so mate, feedback is everyone needs feedback. But so for the people, just a little bit about yourself, where they can find you, and a little bit on how you got into it, if you would.
For sure. So as you mentioned, I've been a graphic designer for a while now. I've been doing it for over 20 years, which I almost can't believe myself. And design kind of rolled over into my interest into symbolism many years ago. And so at some point I felt like I needed to kind of launch a platform for me to get some of the symbolic connections that I was looking into off my chest. So I started Symbolic Studies. That's symbolicstudies.com for anyone who's interested. From there, you can find all of my social media accounts, and I have a store on my site where I offer tarot readings and study sessions and things like that. But yeah, I've basically been a lifelong artist creator. And so to me, it would make a lot of sense that I would eventually find sort of the symbolic path. I would say really the catalyst for me to get really into it was buying my first symbolic reference book, which was probably about, I would say maybe like 15 years ago now. And I didn't even realize symbology was a thing. And I was in a bookstore and I came across a book on symbolism, and I was like, oh, this is pretty interesting. It's telling you the symbolism behind, you know, the numbers, number one, number two, the colors, different animals, different shapes, basic icons. And just being very visual, I felt like I connected with it pretty quickly. And then I made that sort of a hobby of mine to look into other symbolic reference books. And so over the last 15 years or so, I've pretty much built up a pretty, you know, grand, but, you know, fairly decent sized little library, I would say. It's grand in its scope, and kind of, you know, with some of these books, it's kind of grand in its might, maybe, and maybe what kind of some of these books encapsulate. And so it's by no means like a large library, but to me, it really has kind of allowed me to explore so many different symbols that I would get into later on in life, like astrology and things like that. So my sort of, I guess, angle with symbolism is that I really like to go down to the nuts and bolts with things, or at least I try to. So if I'm researching a sign, as an example, I look at all of the different symbols that are kind of associated with that sign. Or if I'm studying a tarot card, I'll look at all of the different associations with that card. And so this has really given me kind of a solid sort of framework, I guess, to use. And I just kind of fell in love with this path, the symbolic path. And at some point, my design skills led me to the tarot. Actually, I had a friend that wanted to build a tarot website, and I had never looked into the cards myself. And he asked if I would design it. And I said, sure. And he said, if you're going to design it, you know, you should maybe know something about the cards. And so he bought like a dozen books on the tarot. He let me borrow a few. And as soon as I started reading that first book, I was completely blown away. I was like, wow, this is a much deeper system than I realized. And at that point, because I've always been a creative and because I went to film school and things like that, I thought I kind of knew about symbolism already, but I realized that I had a lot more to learn. So the tarot really opened me up to wanting to know more about astrology, psychology, mythology, you know, all of these different types of things.
It's a super interesting word that you just used a second ago, and that was system when describing the tarot. Now, I've been thinking about this a lot recently. Is now I'm a massive simulation theory sort of guy. Now, I don't mean it in a sort of artificial computerized simulation, but a natural one, an organic one, if you know, so to speak. And the tarot is very, I know a little bit about it. I'm not an expert by any means, but it's very strange how, and I suppose it links with, you know, other things that are sort of metaphysical in nature, in that it almost taps into this other realm that we live alongside in a weird way. What do you think? Now, this might be a very bit of a vague question, but what do you think is the mechanism for tarot? And go into a little bit what sort of tarot means to you. Like, it's so hard for me to articulate because I don't know enough about it. But yeah, what do you think is driving tarot behind it?
Yeah, well, you know, I think a lot of divination systems essentially operate in a much the same way, in a lot of the same ways. And so I think that the tarot is an attempt to present you a map of more etheric planes. And I think really what it is, it's trying to show you a map of the spirit realm, essentially. And when you look at the major arcana, so I'm not sure how much you do and don't know about it, but there's two main halves of the tarot. So there's the minor arcana, and then there's the major arcana. And the major arcana has, you know, all of the cards that people know the tarot to be associated with: the Tower card, the Death card, the Fool, Magician, things like that. And the major arcana is really more closely associated, I would say, with spirit. And I would say with narrative and with the human story. And it's cyclical. And so once you go through the tarot, right, you start with the Fool, which is zero. You move on through the 22 cards of the major arcana. You end with the Universe card, and then you start right over again. And so to me, this cyclical nature is very much related to this reality as well. You know, it seems as though there's this pattern here where things revolve and rotate. I believe it was maybe Mark Twain or someone else said something along the lines of, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And so there's a lot having to do with cycles and with movement and with these grand sort of transitions, I think, with the tarot. And I think that this reality, kind of what we live within, you know, it's kind of likened to maybe a great wheel or something along these lines, or perhaps a spiral. And so I think the tarot is an attempt to kind of convey the essence of the cosmos, of the universe itself, and kind of the totality of everything here. So the masculine, the feminine, the physical, the metaphysical, you know, all of the things that we kind of experience before us. So the range of human emotions, the different aspects of our spirit, of our psychology. I think as a system, it attempts to kind of encapsulate all of these things. And I think that a lot of divination systems essentially are trying to do the same thing. To me, the thing is it accurately depicting, you know, this domain or this reality? And in some ways, I feel like we won't ever really truly know. You know, there's kind of some faith, I think, in a certain way that you're putting into these systems, because they're explaining grand, great concepts. And some of them, I don't know if it's really in our sort of scope as humans to kind of fully understand here. I kind of see it that as humans living on Earth, that we're kind of limited to certain types of information here. And so it's kind of like this system is a good sort of pursuit, and it's kind of like a good you know, best guess, I suppose, with these etheric realms. It attempts to be that map, but my personal opinion is you can't really trust any map. The map is not the terrain, you know. So if you look at a physical map that's showing an island as an example, or showing a continent or something along these lines, you know, maps don't accurately always represent the physicality of the space that it's supposed to. And so this is something that I think is very interesting, because it kind of gets into your simulation sort of idea, or, you know, things related to that. And so when you're looking at Google Maps, it's like, how accurate is that to our actual real reality, you know?
Yeah, that's a great point. That is a great point. It's so when it comes to like tarot, there's, as you say, there's the minor and the major arcana. Are they are they more of, say, sort of like a format in a sense? Is there other decks? Like, so for example, it's do apologize, it's midnight. I'm finding it hard to articulate. But when it comes to, say, like other, say, like the Solobushka tarot from Italy, is that in it, would that be either a major arcana or a minor arcana, or is that completely separate?
Yeah, so basically there is a major and a minor section to like the Solobushka, but it doesn't follow what the traditional sort of formatting is for the tarot that most people kind of use today. And that's another great angle actually to discuss. I'm glad you brought that up, because the tarot isn't something, in my opinion, and divination systems are like this too, but it's not like it's something that's settled and then it's just done. You know, it's not like you have this system and this is all it'll ever be and it'll never change and it has to be this way and it has to be just supplanted or planted in you know, all of our sort of memories as one particular thing. To me, it's a organic thing. You know, it's something that evolves and changes and kind of unfurls for different people. And I think that we're kind of all encouraged actually to see what might need to be updated. You know, there are some great occultists over the last couple hundred years where they saw things differently. And they were like, you know what? It doesn't make sense for this card to be this number. It makes sense for this card to be this number. It doesn't make sense for this Hebrew letter to be associated with this specific card. I see it as this. And so to me, divination systems, they're like a living, breathing sort of thing. And so you or myself or anyone else, you can create your own deck of cards. And if you see things differently and you feel like you have sort of the right intention behind these changes or whatever, you're more than welcome to do it. It doesn't mean that other people are going to catch on or agree with you. But the realm of symbolism, you know, to me, it's very much, it's kind of always up for interpretation. And that's actually one of the things that I think some people find frustrating about, you know, symbolic sort of literacy. It's kind of hard for them to wrap their head around that this one symbol can not only represent this male deity, but also this female deity, but also this planet, and also this other thing, you know. So you are a participant kind of in all of this. And so you are welcome to make changes, and you're welcome to come out sort of with your own systems if you think it makes sense that way. And so to me, I very much see these books, if you will, these tarot decks, as living and breathing sorts of things. And there's many different sort of interpretations about, you know, the major arcana and, you know, what symbols we should associate with which cards and all of that. And kind of my perspective is I'm more of a syncretist, I suppose. So I'd rather know all of the variations, and I'd rather know why this particular author or creator designed things this way. Maybe they have a really good point. You know, maybe I had never considered that this card should be associated with this planet, but they see it like that. Maybe there's something to gain from being flexible that way. And so there's many, many different opinions about, you know, kind of the standard deck and what all it should entail or encode. And I tend to lean on older decks, and I tend to lean on older sort of ways of viewing the tarot. But it's up for grabs, and it's up for debate, you know, what people want to do with it and what they think might be right with it.
Yeah, sort of like a create your own tarot, like just all bets are off, just do what you want. And I did look at the Solar Bushka tarot a while ago, and when we booked this interview, I thought, I'm going to go back and have a look just to sort of like refresh my memory. And geez, man, that's some of it's quite dark. Like you have, you've got like the baby being held over the fire pit. Like that obviously speaks to child sacrifice in a way. I have heard of, and now we can get into the symbology of the hexagram and the hexagon to denote Saturn, but I have heard that I don't know how true this is, again, because I'm not a tarot expert, but there's links to the Solar Bushka tarot being some form of sort of like symbolism of the sort of like a Saturnian cult, like so a lot of Saturn symbology. Do you see that yourself?
Right. Yeah, that's the main association. There's a book called The Game of Saturn, and that's kind of the book that was published within, I think, the last 10 years or so that exposed a lot of esoteric information about the Solar Bushka that was previously, I think, unknown to a lot of people. I do see a Saturnian connection. Saturn is a very, very interesting planet. It encodes so much information. I have a reverence for Saturn, I think maybe more than some people do, because a lot of people think it's a spooky planet and that it's dark and malefic. And certainly, you know, those sort of ideas associated with it, that stuff is true. You know, it's kind of undeniable, but it's also been known as like this great teacher. And I think that a lot of lessons are actually kind of Saturnian lessons in a lot of ways. And so for someone to see the Saturnian influence on the Solar Bushka, definitely I can see that all day long. Just like you mentioned with the child sacrifice thing, you know, Saturn was known for eating his children, right? So that's a clear sort of thing that you see in the deck with that card. I believe that card's called Neroni. And so I see that, but I see that there's even, you know, more things kind of associated with it. So I don't personally see it as just like a Saturnian deck exclusively. I think that there were other influences, but from my understanding of things, it was really commissioned by a wealthy family. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that only one deck has really ever survived, you know, history. And so what was the intention with this family? You know, what was their bloodline all about? Were they, you know, worshiping Saturn? Was that just one of the planets that they kind of honored or worked with? You know, are there other things in there that they wanted to kind of convey or evoke? I'll say that one of the fascinating things to me about this deck is that there is still a lot of mystery to be unveiled. There's still a lot of things that people don't understand about that deck. And that's what's drawn me into wanting to know more about it and wanting to work with it on a research sort of level. I have a really good copy here from Scarlet Imprint, and I love it. I think it's a fantastic deck. And when I've looked through it over the years, I pick up on things that I've never heard anyone else talk about, not even in the Game of Saturn. And so it's kind of like this deck that's waiting for people to spend time with it and waiting for people to uncover more of its secrets. There's subliminal imagery in this deck that you don't see in a lot of newer decks. And so there's little tells, there's little symbols, there's little details that mean a lot. And I just find it incredible that some of these little insights, some of these little secrets, if you will, which is what our arcana means, by the way. So the major secrets and the lesser secrets. There's still a lot of secrets in that deck that people haven't talked about publicly. And so if people are interested in like puzzles and decoding and things like that, the Solabusca is kind of an amazing find for anyone who kind of has that sort of tendency. But yeah, certainly Saturn for sure, I think, plays a part in this deck. Just with everything that I know Saturn to represent, I see its sort of signatures all over the place with it within the artwork.
Yes. See, Saturn's a tricky one, isn't it? Because you hear things like, so David Icke, for example, he talks a lot about Saturn and the sort of like frequencies it gives off, keeping us in this prison planet or whatever. And then, you know, you have these people, say, for example, in the UK, up a bit further north than where I live, there's I found it, there's a Mason, a Freemasonic lodge that sort of like worships Saturn. And you see a lot of like Saturn symbology. I actually, funnily enough, my company, Cosmic, is the logo is Saturn, because I thought if anyone's going to be worshiping Saturn, it's going to be rich people, and that's who I want as customers. You know, they want to see this symbology and they want to see, you know, this guy knows what he's talking about. You know what I'm saying? But in terms of so let's turn it around a little bit to get back to your YouTube channel a little bit, because I want to get into some of the stuff. Wow, just absolutely blew my mind. I pulled this from your YouTube channel that, see, a lot of people are blind to astrology. A lot of people, you know, they think it's, you know, kooky or whatever, but that's obviously what it's made to look like. That's the Mystic Meg, the back of the newspaper horoscope type bullshit. But there's real world, like really, really real world things that people take for granted that are taken straight out of astrology, like the zodiac. And I found this on your YouTube channel that the LB in pound comes directly from Libra Pondo. Pondo corresponds with pound, and the LB, yeah, is pound, is Libra. I mean, that is, I would never have known that if I didn't see your channel. That is insane. But one of the main thing that really caught my attention is this connection between the constellation, well, the zodiac sign Cancer and Capricorn and the gateways symbology. Go into that a little bit, because I think that is huge.
Yeah, for sure. No, that was something that, you know, when I learned that, I was really intrigued with it as well. And I'm like, there's something here. It really resonated with me on a few levels, in part because I'm a Cancer and my fiance is a Capricorn as well.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So we're on the opposite end of the zodiac wheel. And so I've learned a lot about Capricorn and Saturn because of her. And then she's learned a lot about Cancer and the moon because of me. And so it's this really interesting polarity between the two. But essentially, the Babylonians and other groups had this idea that man comes through. And I think that we can get into the concept of what portals or gateways, you know, what that's really all about, too, because my opinion about gateways has kind of shifted over the years, because there's a lot of different claims about, you know, these different entry and exit points. And one of these ideas is that Cancer is considered the gateway of man, and that man enters through symbolically through this sign. So Cancer is associated with the moon. It's the only sign that's actually ruled by the moon. And the only signs that are ruled by the sun and the moon are right next to each other. So it's Leo and the sun, and then Cancer and the moon. And so the moon is very feminine, right? So it's very receptive. Depending on the culture, most people associate it with woman. That lunar symbolism is associated with the feminine. There are some cultures that see it the other way around. They see the moon as being masculine and the sun as being feminine. But for the most part, I do see the traditional sort of correspondence. And so when you take that into account, it's almost kind of like this lunar sort of idea that, you know, we come through woman. So we come through the womb of woman. and her nature being more receptive and man's nature being more projective, right? So the moon constantly changes. It constantly shifts. So in the night sky, you're going to see it wax and wane, right? So you're going to see the full moon to the new moon. It's always evolving. It's always morphing. And so man has actually been compared to the moon many, many times over. And so it's been said that we're kind of moon children in a lot of ways. And when a woman gets pregnant, right, she swells up, her belly gets big. And that's very much a lunar sort of symbol as well. You know, a pregnant woman and her fullness when she's going to bear a child, and even her breasts, right, and getting large and then full of milk, right? These are all very lunar sort of ideas in nature. The idea of milk, too, being related to the moon is something that you'll find. And so to me, it kind of makes sense that man would come via Cancer, and Cancer is the crab, right? Lives in the water. The crab is known for retreating. The crab is known for hiding and kind of scuttling away. The crab has a hard exterior, but a soft interior. And so he's guarded that way. The crab is guarded sort of symbolically. And the crab is also known as being like an underworld creature. That's something that you'll find when you look into crab symbolism. And actually, woman, to me, is more closely associated with the underworld as well. In fact, I'm getting ready to give a presentation here in a couple of days. And one of the things I'll be talking about is how when a man has sex with a woman, he's actually symbolically taking a trip to the underworld. So the phallus is taking a trip to the underworld, and the womb symbolically is the underworld as well. And so the underworld symbolism that's associated with the woman is very, very strong, and it's very, very potent. And there's a lot that can be said about all of that. And so even man, the gateway of man, the word man, M-A-N, goes back, in my opinion, to the moon. So man and men go back to the moon. So men as in menstruation, right? And so the cycles of a woman being related to the moon, symbolically having been related to the moon. Even words like minute goes back to the moon. So a lot of words that are M, vowel, N, go back to the moon. So month is another word. It's basically moonth. Monday, M-O-N, it's basically moon day, right? Even mound or something like that goes back to the moon, going back to sort of the pregnancy idea, and even just kind of the roundness of the moon and the crescent moon kind of symbolically representing a vessel. It's almost like it contains something. And so a lot of words, man, min, men, words that start like that actually go back to the moon, because the moon was essentially a measuring tool for a really long time. And so this is related to what I refer to as the lunar tradition. I think there's been three major symbolic traditions, which we can get into if you want. But there's the solar tradition, lunar tradition, and then also the stellar slash polar tradition. And so everything with Cancer and the moon falls in line with the lunar tradition, generally looked at as being very feminine. So this is what we symbolically sort of come through. Now, the opposite end of that would be the gateway of the gods, which would be Capricorn, which is ruled by Saturn. And so when I think of Saturn, you know, I think of the color black, I think of lead, I think of the earth also underneath our feet, right? So I think of like the physicality of this reality, of this domain. And so the idea is that we come through the gateway of Cancer, and then we exit through the gateway of the gods. And so this has been a tradition that's kind of been passed down for a long time. And so that's generally, you know, kind of the sort of framework behind this entry point and exit point. But what's really interesting is you're going to find that essentially every single sign has had symbolism associated with it. That's kind of similar. So Gemini has been looked at as a gateway. Taurus has been looked at as a gateway. Sagittarius has been looked at as a gateway. A lot of the signs in the zodiac have kind of been likened to a portal or an opening of some kind. And my personal opinion, just to kind of continue unpacking this idea of gateways, is that I think there's a preeminent gateway in the heavens that perhaps is the original gateway or the original vein or river system, if you will. And it has to do with the northern sky. And it has to do with this idea that we originate either in the north or in the northern sky, and then we return to the north or to the northern sky. And it seems as though this is sort of the earliest tradition that I can kind of find. So a lot of the gateway symbolism associated with the signs of astrology, all of the signs in the zodiac wheel are very much related to the sun, actually, because this is the ecliptic. This is the path of the sun. So astrology is actually a system based in solar symbolism, but there was a time before solar symbolism. And so to me, from what I gather, and I talk about this a lot more on other shows, and I haven't really done a complete deep dive on my own channel, but it seems to me like the earliest system was what I refer to as the stellar or polar tradition. And it's this idea that there's a symbolic connection with the North Pole and the northern sky. And so in the northern sky, you have the pole star or Polaris or the North Star, and that this connection between the North Pole and the pole star, it's referred to as the world axis or the axis mundi. And so it's this idea that the heavens revolve around one point. And so if you look in the night sky, all of the stars, excluding the wandering stars, the planets, all of the stars in the sky revolve around one point. And so there's an axle that we're dealing with here. And the axle symbolically has been associated with this North Star. So the heavens have been looked at as a great wheel, if you will, that just turns in the heavens. And that axle, that sort of that midpoint in the heavens, has been looked at as kind of like a transitional sort of point. It's like a point of transcendence, if you will. And so I think that for a lot of early cultures, this was the gateway that they kind of concerned themselves with. And I think a lot of the symbolism associated with what I'm referring to here, this stairway to heaven at the north, I think a lot of the symbolism that was originally associated with this northern sort of entry and exit was later sort of transposed onto other points in the sky. That's kind of my opinion. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah. As much as it can. It's so deep. It's like, even when you were mentioning the etymology of it, it seems to me, listening to people like yourself, Dr. Narco Longo, who was on the show a couple of episodes ago, it seems they are very much intertwined, etymology and astrology. And this sort of like, so it's so strange. It's when you really look at it, like, when, like, as you said, like the M vowel and then the N is everywhere. And then you see, like, Mercury, for example, you see the Merc everywhere, like Mercedes, mercenary, like obviously mercurial, like all these words that are just, it's so strange to me. But when it comes to these ancient cultures that really studied the stars, like, for me, I can't wrap my head around how they all, so they're all looking up in the sky at these, I would imagine, obviously we have a lot of light, you know, pollution now, but they would have seen these really elaborate shows in the sky. And for them to all, you know, because for me, like, just seeing the pictures of it, like, it's hard to pick out what is what for me. Obviously I haven't studied it, you know, and I don't live in those conditions, so obviously it's going to be quite hard for me. But what would you say in terms of, like, say, the earliest sort of like evidence of this zodiac is?
I see. Very interesting. Well, I mean, are you referring specifically to the zodiac, like the 12 signs of astrology, or are you referring to perhaps just the, you know, just star sort of lore in general?
Yeah, I think To be fair, I could have phrased that better. I do apologize. But the so in terms of like both of it, really, just understanding the stars and mapping the stars in that symbolic nature, like where is the root of that?
I mean, that's an awesome question. Well, it's awesome actually that you say root, because really, when symbolically nowadays, when I look at the night sky, I have an acknowledgement and I have an awareness that what we are actually looking at is something of our root system. And so we're looking at where we came from. And so we're looking at the origin of things. And so symbolically, it's really interesting. I think a good example just to kind of help anyone wrap their head around this is looking at Virgo. And so Virgo, right? So Virgo comes after Leo. It's just before Libra. She's known as the Virgin. And so one of the things is that she is known as being the Queen of Heaven and also the Queen of Earth. And so there's this as above, so below kind of dynamic that you get with her. And she's related to Mercury as well. Mercury rules Virgo. Mercury rules a couple of signs. Gemini in its sort of airy aspect, and then Virgo in its more earthy aspect. And so Mercury is known as being a divine androgyne. So Mercury is masculine and feminine. He kind of can embrace his light side and his dark side. And so there is this duality with Mercury and completion as well because of that, this polarity with mercurial sort of symbolism. And so Virgo being the Queen of Heaven and Queen of Earth, I've always thought that was very, very interesting. So she's related not only to the night sky and to the stars, but she's also related to the soil, you know, underneath our feet. And the more you actually look into it, the more you'll realize that symbolically, there's a huge correspondence between the soil of Earth and the heavens and the night sky. And so as an example, you sow a seed into the ground, right? And so a seed germinates underground. Likewise, you know, if you're going to, you know, have a child, it's going to germinate within the womb of mom, right? In the darkness of things, right? And so Virgo is associated with veil symbolism as well. And so she's associated with bridal symbolism. And so this is why a young woman on her wedding day, she's veiled, and then the veil is lifted and she no longer is a virgin. You know, symbolically, this is the end of her virginity, right? And virginity used to mean just unwed or without a partner. And so the Queen of Heaven aspect, as it relates to this idea of being unwed, is that there's this old idea that the cosmos is feminine, essentially, and that she is the original essence here. Sometimes she's referred to as the creatrix. There's many, many names for her, but we're dealing with the primordial mother, the dark mother. She's gone by many names. There's many goddesses that she's associated with. But the idea is that she was the original sort of deity here. And deep within her, behind a series of veils, symbolically, she created a counterpart. She created a masculine presence. And so if you're going to look at things from a Gnostic perspective, this would be like Sophia and the Demiurge. Mm-hmm. And so Sophia had the Demiurge deep, deep, deep within her, this light within her. And this was actually her child, her son, S-O-N or S-U-N. And so the feminine, the goddess, being associated with this darkness, with this sort of primordial or chaotic sort of energy. And then man generally is associated with the light, right? So it's interesting, right, that we refer to the sun as a sun, and then we, you know, a young male is a sun, S-O-N. And so when you're looking into the heavens, you're looking into the spirit realm, in my opinion. You know, where I come from with things is that I think that we've kind of been given a false idea of what's happening in the night sky, that we've been told that we can go to these different planets, as an example, and that we can land on them. And at least with my education, I was taught about the planets, but in a very, very superficial sort of way. You know, how big the moon is, how far away Mars is, you know, these, you know, they give us this model of what they refer to as the solar system, And I don't see it that way. I see it that when you're looking in the night sky, you are literally looking at the spirit realm. But it's become more of a physical sort of thing. People have this physical sort of interpretation of what's happening up there. And I see it as more of a etheric sort of thing. I see it more as a spiritual sort of thing. And I see it as, like what I was getting to earlier, as kind of where we come from. It's our root system. So, you know, you have to imagine that when people were living in a more, I know this word is very triggering for some people, but in a more primitive sort of way, and you didn't have television, right? There was no internet or YouTube or podcasts or anything like that. And you were out there, the night sky really popped, you know, as you're saying, with light pollution, you really can't see the stars that well. And so imagine back in the day, you were able to see the stars. This was your tradition. You know, I think that people just naturally have looked above and symbolically associated what's happening above with the heavens, with God, if you will. And if you're looking above and it's at night, you're going to naturally, I think, notice these patterns in the sky. You're going to notice that, oh, that star over there is really bright. Maybe we should pay attention to that one. Or, oh, you know, this constellation kind of looks like this or that. I think that there was an oral tradition, you know, that was passed down to people, and they saw the heavens as kind of like their divination system. So here we have, you know, we were talking about tarot earlier. I think people, instead of looking at the tarot, they were looking at things like the night sky. And if you lived in like a desert, as an example, which you'll notice that a lot of names of stars and constellations and things like that, they come from the Middle East. You know, a lot of names are Abrahamic, you know, in nature, or sorry, Arabic. And so it's very, very interesting that this is the case. But if you're out in the desert and there are few mountains around or no mountains around, your impression of the heavens is different than, say, if you lived in a mountainous area where there's lots of trees, or you can only see a portion of the sky. So where I live in the U.S., in the Pacific Northwest, there's large pine trees all over the place. So what I can see, and there's a mountain, you know, right in front of my place, so I can see a portion of the night sky, and I'm happy to have available what I can see. But I was just camping this past weekend out in the desert, and man, I was blown away because I hadn't seen, you know, that expansive night sky in a long time. And I was like, holy shit, you can see so many stars. It was almost kind of confusing a little bit because I'm not used to seeing that much night sky. But I was able to see way more constellations than usual. And it kind of reminded me that if you live out in a place like this with low light pollution, you know, minimal mountains and things like that, it makes sense that you would kind of create a storybook out of what's happening there in the heavens. So I think it's just, it's intrinsic, because I think that what you're looking at is, you're literally looking at the underworld, if you want to call it that. You're either looking at heaven or the underworld. You're looking at the spirit realm. And so this is what we come from. This is where we return to, in my estimation, in my opinion. And so to me, it would make sense that from the get-go, as long as humans have been able to see, they've been looking upward and have been mystified with what they've seen. And in terms of divination and stuff, you know, this is how they rolled. If a certain planet was in a certain constellation, they would create these little stories out of, you know, what does it mean when the planet Mars, which is fiery and red, enters into Leo or something? You know, they kind of created these little narratives and these little storylines. And actually, I think it was a lot simpler back in the day. It was kind of likened to almost like a children's book or something. I think that they kind of had this sort of organic way of looking at the sky and very much like a folk way of looking at the sky. Whereas today, if you talk to more of a modern astrologer, they're going to be showing you these charts and graphs and angles and degrees and all this kind of stuff. And I think that some of the sort of natural spiritual quality, I think it's kind of lost in the sauce a little bit. I think people get really hung up on a lot of the technical side of things. But I think that, you know, our ancestors, I think they had a much simpler way of looking at the heavens. And so that's just kind of my general take. Hopefully I answered your question, though.
Yeah, 100%. You gave me some bits to really think about in the way that I think about things as well, is when you mention the stars. And it's so strange to me that, and it should be strange to everyone, but you know, a lot of people just don't care, is when you think about how the stars rotate, they do rotate around a fixed point.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, given what we're told, like I'm from that, I sit on the fence between flat earth and globe. I don't believe it's flat or a globe. I don't know what it is. I think it's just a realm. I don't think there is a shape to it. It's hard to say, to be honest, because there's so much CGI and stuff, like the bubbles in the tanks and, you know, the wires and the green screen. And it's there. For me, I agree with you. Like the planets, like I think what you were saying is you don't think, now correct me if I'm wrong, is you don't really think that they are something that you can actually land on. And I don't think that either, because like, I know this is a little bit off topic, but the moon landings, obviously, like the only people that say that they did land on the moon is the people that haven't never seen the footage or haven't seen it since they seen it when they were a child, you know. It's right. Obviously painstakingly obvious, but when we think about the stars in general, and it's so interesting that you say that it's like sort of like the spirit world, because if you, I've seen these, you know, videos of people zooming in right to the stars, and it looks like some form of, you know, frequency or water,
right,
or something. It's so strange. But actually, when you think about, you know, even biblically, you know, they separated the waters from the waters. The firmament, I know firmament's very entry level, you know, flat earth sort of stuff, but there is all this talk of, you know, waters as well. And then
right,
it's super strange. Like, is it possible that we can visit these things? Like, it's just, it's so weird to me. But
yeah,
when it comes to so like astrology in that sense, does it give us any clues as to if these are actually physical places or not?
Well, I mean, this is right up my alley. And so my conclusion is this, real quick, regarding flat versus round and all of that. I see a lot of baggage with the term flat earth. And so I personally actually don't use that myself. I understand when people refer to it, it's almost like the common way to explain geocentrism, or to refer to geocentrism. So I use geocentrism. I think it's more accurate, because really when you're having this debate, and this debate has raged on for a very, very, very long time, flat versus round, what you're really talking about, at least the way I tend to perceive it, is it's a matter of spin. And it's, are you saying that the heavens are spinning, or are you saying that the earth is spinning? And I would say that that's mainly what you're talking about. And so I see it as the earth is stationary and the heavens are spinning. Heliocentrism, the round earth model, is saying the exact opposite, that we are spinning. And so to me, that's kind of fundamentally what it comes down to, is this issue of spin. Does it feel like, you know, I mean, just, there's a whole thing about whether, how much you can trust your senses here, you know, but your own perception of things, you know, does it appear as though what's happening above is spinning, or what's happening underneath your feet is spinning? And so I see it as what's happening above our heads is spinning. And it appears as though a lot of ancient groups saw it that way as well, that they did not think that the earth is spinning. So flat earth as kind of a title has a lot of baggage with it, as I'm saying. But in terms of visiting the planets, this is a really, really interesting topic of discussion, because what we're told in mainstream media and what we're told, you know, in our education system is that you can get on a rocket and you can visit the planets. And I don't believe this is physically true, but it's true on an astral level. It's true on an ascension level. And in fact, this is what is being sort of miscommunicated, I suppose, or what's being covered up. And so for a long time, a lot of different groups had this idea that you can astral travel out of this plane. Now, there's debate on whether or not you can do it permanently or if it's always temporary. I'm kind of the opinion that generally it's temporary. Your physical body can be here, but you can go to another location. You can travel and visit these other planes of dimension. And the idea is that you actually, if you want to go from planet to planet, you need to start with the moon. The moon is the first planet. That's kind of like a stepping stone, or it's kind of like a gateway. And so the moon is kind of considered to be one of the luminaries that we have the closest bond with. And I think this is for a lot of different reasons. You know, obviously it's bigger, you know, in terms of a perspective sort of thing. So we can actually see, you know, definition on the moon. We can see details and things like that. The sun, obviously, you're not going to be looking at the sun for very long. And the moon, though, right, we have the man on the moon. We have these different craters we can see. If you have a simple telescope, you can see more detail, things like that. And so for a long time, people have thought of the moon as being this gateway to the other planets. And so if you're going to travel astrally, you need to work with the moon first. It's the first luminary that you actually want to build a relationship with and use as this stepping stone. And then Saturn under this system would be the end of the line. So it'd be the last planet in the traditional seven planetary sort of dynamic. So the moon is considered to be the first gateway out of here, and then also the last gate before you come back here. And so there's several books that I've read that really get into this very nicely. I'll recommend one book for people. It's called Stairway to Heaven by Peter Lavenda. And he gets into all of this material. Now, what we've been told today is that we can do this physically. And so what I think has happened is the propaganda spin is that people have been doing this metaphysically, spiritually, astrally for a very, very long time. And there's lots of different sort of systems that people have created to do this. And in the modern world, it's been flipped on its head. And we've been shown, again, through films and video games and commercials and things like that, that humanity can accomplish this physically. But that's the trick, is that I don't see us being able to do that physically. You do it metaphysically. And so I personally don't think we can physically leave this space. So I don't think we go anywhere. I think this is something of a closed system, kind of to your point, because we live in a field. This is more of a field than anything, you know? And so I see this field as being related to a torus field as well. And that the center of a torus field, which, for people who don't know, the torus field is something like a donut, right? And so this opening in the middle of the toroidal field, the hyperbola, that is the stairway to heaven. So to me, what I see is that we live in a nested toroidal sort of structure, and we live on what's referred to, some people have called it, the plane of inertia. And so we kind of live in kind of a flatter sort of field or disc within this torus field, but we are bonded to it. So we're bonded to it in a way that we, I don't think, can actually leave here physically, you know? And I kind of see it that Earth might very well be center stage too of the universe and the cosmos. And that's another fundamental difference between you know, geocentrism or flat earth and heliocentrism. Heliocentrism, right? It's like we live on this spinning ball in infinite space and everything's random and by chance and, you know, you're insignificant, right? And so under the flat earth geocentric way of looking at things and under what I perceive to be kind of like the earliest symbolic tradition, the stellar or polar tradition, they considered this place to be very much like a divine sort of realm. Not to say that bad things, quote unquote, bad things don't happen here. This is a brutal place, you know, so you're going to experience heartache and pain and, you know, things of this nature. But I think that's kind of the point, actually. I think that this is really kind of like a place to train your soul, you know, in a lot of ways. And I think it's just one of these sort of acts of divine sort of balance is that, well, if you want to, you know, live here physically and you want to experience, you know, physical love or the material things in life, if you want to have a carnal sort of nature, if you want to be able to eat food and, you know, travel places and breathe air and, you know, all of these different types of things, there has to be some sort of give and take with that, that you can't just have physicality without, you know, some of these other things being in play, you know, violence and what have
you. Yeah, you now that is reminiscent for me of this type of things that I'm sure you're aware of his work. Santos Bonacci sort of says when he talks about, you know, everything that's happening here is happening for a reason. I know that, I mean, that comes with an awful lot of baggage too, because, you know, you talk about sort of like human trafficking, you know, these child slaves, sex slaves, stuff like that, you know, and someone that isn't really, you know, versed in that sort of work would say, well, are you trying to say that, you know, that is happening for the good of, you know, mankind or the, you know, the greater good or whatever? But that's obviously a bit of a thorny subject. Obviously, I don't mind getting into it, but when it comes to, now here's the question that I was sort of building up to. I hear a lot of talk about, you know, signing these soul contracts before we come back to this plane, and then it wipes our memory because that's part of the game, part of the sort of mission, you know, to ascend spiritually. As a soul, as a, you know, like a sort of like eternal being, I suppose. But what are your thoughts on that whole sort of soul contract aspect of it? Do you follow that at all?
Yeah, I've definitely heard people talk about that for sure. So I tend to lean on the idea that essentially, you know, whether you signed this contract and came here to fulfill, you know, those obligations or not. I'm not sure. I definitely have had those opinions where I'm like, I really feel as though, as an example, you know, purpose, right? What's your purpose? I kind of feel like my purpose here is to talk about symbolism, you know? And so I feel like this could have been, you can say this is part of my soul contract, right? Is to kind of talk about this stuff, research it, understand it as best as I can, teach it, you know, but also allow it to help me grow, you know, as a person and help me get closer to my true authenticity, which I refer to as like my true north, right? So I think there's something to be said about it. I don't have like a hard line sort of opinion on yes, absolutely, this is how it is, or no, that's not how it is. I'm open to it for sure. The memory wipe thing is very interesting to me because I do see it that way. And there's lots of old myths that kind of indicate that this is the case, that, you know, when you incarnate here, however it's done, I've read mythology that kind of associates it with like a drink, that you're given some sort of intoxicant. And actually, it's interesting because the vessel for that drink has been related to the craters of the moon. And that there's this grail sort of association with it, that symbolically your soul is given this drink, this, you know, wine, if you will, or some sort of intoxicant that does wipe your memory so that you don't have any recollection of your previous lives or what have you, and that it kind of needs to be done this way, that there needs to be some sort of partition here, that you're almost kind of, your soul is almost in this bubble, perhaps, when it's here. But there's actually kind of a more expansive sort of aspect to it. But I see this place as essentially, to be honest with you, I have this radical acceptance sort of philosophy that I think this place is perfectly balanced, and I don't see anything wrong with what's happening here. And so there are wars that are being fought right now. There's an insane amount of propaganda at play. There's all of these different, you know, agendas at play as well. Transhumanism, on down the line. I spent, you know, many years looking into all of these rabbit holes, you know, ufology, cryptid sort of stuff, MK Ultra, you know, all of these different types of things. Not saying I know it all or that I'm an expert, but what I found out was that a lot of this stuff induces fear, and that there's this fear-mongering sort of thing, I think, with portions of kind of the truth or conspiratorial community. And after a while, I just stopped buying the fear aspect of it, where I know a lot of people actually in person who are interested in a lot of this material. So I've been able to have many conversations over the last decade with dozens and dozens of people. And at a certain point, I kind of realized, I'm like, man, I don't know if I'm afraid. I'm not afraid the same way you guys are afraid. If you're afraid about this politician or this celebrity or this date, that's the other thing. I'm not interested in the forecasting of events, of doomsday type of events. That's something that I left behind many years ago, where I knew people who were saying, oh, did you know that, you know, on November 2nd at this time, this is going to happen or that's going to happen. And it never, ever, ever happened. And so I feel like because I've been exposed to so much of this information, I kind of actually got turned off to it at a certain point. And I feel like I started embracing this idea that actually everything happens here for a reason, you know? So to me, it's just a cause and effect sort of thing. So if I, you know, put my hand into this flame, I have a candle right here on my desk. If I put my hand in this flame, it's going to hurt, you know, cause and effect. And so I think, you know, whatever sort of things you see in this reality, things that might be disturbing, you have to ask yourself, well, is it like this for good reason? And when you look at the history of this place, and when you look at how people live their lifestyle, and when you look at the fact that there are, you know, and again, I'm not trying to be fear-mongery about this, but when you look at the fact that there's families that have an immense amount of control and wealth at their disposal, and they have for hundreds or thousands of years or longer, and when you look at just kind of how everything is unfurling, it makes perfect sense to me that, you know, there's so much homelessness, and that people are trafficked, and that there's wars, you know, happening, and that there's all of these different things that I feel like, you know, are kind of uncomfortable to look at, and people would rather not think that there's some sort of purpose with those things. But I don't see it that way. I think that there's actually a silver lining to all of these things. And this gets into my opinion about health as well, you know, where Mother Nature doesn't make mistakes. Your body doesn't make mistakes. If you get sick, it's for a very good reason, you know. So I'm of the opinion that Mother Nature and whatever this system is, I have more faith in it than not. And that's kind of given me sort of a new kind of armor or a new kind of strength that I don't think I had before when I thought that things were imperfect here. So I have, just to further illustrate this, I have friends who are really interested in this matrix concept, right? Mm-hmm. And I see it kind of like what you said. You said it's something of an organic sort of thing more so. And I have these friends that want to break out of the matrix. They want to do one of two things. They either want to break out of the matrix, or they want to break the matrix itself. There's a line of thinking, there's like this kind of newer magical tradition, I guess you can say, called anti-cosmicism. And so it's people who are anti-cosmic. And so they're literally trying to break the fabric of reality. And to me, I don't think it's about escaping the matrix. I don't think it's about breaking the matrix. I actually think it's about accepting the matrix. And that I think a lot of people's sort of internal issues have to do with the lack of acceptance of self. And I think that if you have a difficult time accepting self, then you're going to have a difficult time accepting the world around you as well. And, you know, these things are easier said than done. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't, you know, fight for what's right or defend you and your family or have opinions politically about certain things. But I think I tend to just see the world as being more just than not. And this is actually one of the things Crowley said. So his card that represents justice, he actually called adjustment. And one of the things he said about this card is that nature isn't just, but it's exact. And so things are perfectly balanced here, you know? And so to me, it's like, what more can I ask for? You know, I think that there's good reason to think that what is happening here is done so for a very good reason, even though my human tendency or my human mind or my human heart may not agree with it. It might think it's tragic or I may not understand it. But I think on a grander sort of larger level, I think I more than likely I would perceive it to be being done for a very, very good reason.
Yeah, that is really interesting, that this sort of aspect of, you know, everything is happening for a reason. And what one of the things that you said is when you sort of said, you know, focus on, you know, I don't think you said this exactly, but sort of like the focus on yourself. And I do have, you know, a sort of anecdote, I suppose, about it is I used to really worry about sort of like what people thought about me, like always worried, like even to like sort of like dressing or anything like that, like always like what are people going to think, like whatever. And weirdly, when I got to 30, it sort of went away. And it's, I cannot tell you, and you probably know this yourself, I cannot tell you how liberating it felt for me to say, no one gives a fuck about me. They're focused on themselves. They are. No one's coming to save you. You know, you're in it for yourself. But there's also that notion that, you know, no one's out to get you. They're just in it for themselves. And I know that there is, you know, a global cabal, you know, working, you know, against us or whatever. And I'm the same as you. I'm not, I don't fearmonger. I don't get scared. I sort of take a step back and I just let it happen. Like if people want to go and, you know, give themselves a medical, you know, experiment or medical procedure, do what you want, you know, do what the fuck you want. Just leave me alone. And that's how I live my life now. And that is so liberating because you sort of, you see reality for what it is and you see sort of like the perceptions of, you know, just how you really, really see how, not just how desperate these people are to, you know, stay in control, but you sort of like get the feeling that maybe all this is happening for a reason, even the bad things. You know, in this, not as an apologist to the elites or anything like that, but maybe they are here for that purpose exactly. Maybe that is their purpose, is to, like a diamond, you can't make a diamond without pressure. So maybe that is a mechanism put there by the simulation for us to ascend in a way. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like,
oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I see it something along those lines for sure. And when I look at nature and, you know, how wild animals operate, I think about a lot of this stuff. So I live in an area where I'm lucky enough to be able to see turkeys and deer and elk. And I've ran into, you know, some bear and things like that. And, you know, beforehand I was living in the city. So I'm in my current location. We've been here for like 2 or 2.5 years. And so before that I was in the city. And so I was inside more. I rode my bike more around the city, things like that. But now I'm hiking way more. I'm out in nature way more. And just kind of like seeing how these animals operate and, you know, just their ways and things like that. It's just like, you know, it's a dog eat dog world, you know what I mean, out there. And so it's just like things feed on other things out there. And in the city, it very much works the same way, but the dynamic is different, right? And so when I see how these animals operate in the wild and how they feed and take care of themselves and protect, you know, their family and things like that, it just kind of, it brings me back to this more primal understanding of things where this is a beautiful thing. So if you see a bear, you know, eating another animal, or right, the example I always like to use is the lion and the antelope or something, you know, is that lion evil because it wants to eat that antelope? You know, it's like, it's in the eyes of the beholder. So to that antelope's children, you know, of course they're going to have an opinion about the lion, but to the lion's children, they're going to have a different opinion about what's kind of transpiring here. And so I see that as a very balanced sort of thing, you know, that these animals are here and they, you know, need to survive. And so, you know, one moment the antelope is being killed to feed the lion's family. Who knows? The next moment that lion, you know, might be killed by something else. And so it's just kind of the way of the world is that everything here, it's almost kind of like it's almost like one, you know, it's very toroidal, actually. You know, the torus field, there's an outer expression and an inner expression, but it's cyclical, right? And so things just kind of like fold into itself and then expresses out of itself. And so I just see everything here is kind of like a similar sort of thing where it's this it's the same pattern sort of everywhere, right? But it's just the cycle of life, essentially, is what it is. But what I wanted to say is that focusing on self actually is, to me, more of a geocentric sort of philosophy. I really see heliocentrism and, you know, all of the things that kind of come with it. It actually drains you of your power and it actually takes focus away from you. And so then you end up focusing on other people. So you want external validation. You want external solutions. You want all of these things outside of self, but under sort of the geocentric way of looking at things, there's more of a return to home. There's a more of a return to center, and the earth being that center and this world axis concept being the center. And this actually brings you back to your center. So your true north. So the still point within. So as you start understanding this still point in the heavens, which is the pole star, you actually have more of an understanding of the still point within yourself. And you start having an understanding of your divinity and your power. You know, to me, heliocentrism and kind of this solarization of things, all of the glory goes to an external source, you know, which would be the sun. And the sun is radiant. And all of the things symbolically associated with the sun indicates that it wants your attention. And a lot of solar deities, like I always think of the demiurge, but a lot of solar deities demand your attention. They demand respect. And these solar deities, they tend to think that they are the end all be all deity. They don't realize that there's actually another classification of God above them. There's actually an older tier of deity that came before them. And so I see that there's been this huge switch from polar to solar. And so that's why I like to say that I think it might be more accurate to say personally that we live in a polar system, but and not a solar based system, that that's kind of been the inversion. And this has kind of been my quest over the last handful of years, is understanding this transition from polar to solar symbolism. So there's a lot of deities that are associated with the sun, but back in the day, they were actually associated with the north or the northern sky or the pole star. And so there's a lot of deities that are actually polar deities, not solar deities, but there has been this solarization. There's been this flip from polar to solar. And with this flip also came the flip of the reverence of the feminine to the masculine. And also with this idea of internal sort of understanding, this internal dialogue, focusing on the internal journey, because I'm of the opinion that if you know yourself, you'll know the universe, right? So there's been this flip from this internal feminine sort of idea to a more external sort of masculine idea. And if you look at the world the way it is, you know, to me, it feels very solar sort of in nature. So I see that we live in this solar sort of age. And with that comes, you know, this massive sacrifice of self. And it's more so about the community, and which I think, you know, it sounds great, you know, but in actuality, it comes with a lot of issues, because if you're not agreeing with the community, you're blacklisted, you're exiled, you're no longer part of it. So this idea of community has really been weaponized, actually, over the last however many years, decades upon decades. And I see very much that this, some people refer to this as, or there's an interesting thread that people can pull out called communitarianism, and just kind of like what this all means. But with this sort of community oriented sort of philosophy, you realize that it doesn't help the individual at the end of the day. At the end of the day, it really helps more of the system at large. Focusing on self, getting your priorities in order, understanding your internal compass, your true north, your true authenticity. I think that's kind of the last thing that the powers that be, you know, that's what they don't want. They don't want you to focus on that.
Yeah, and that definitely speaks to that, you know, is I could take care of myself sort of mentality. You know, I don't need your helping hand, government. You know, you don't need to come in and, you know, quote unquote, help me, you know.
Just, in fact, please don't help me. I don't want your assistance.
Stay the fuck away from me. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the further the better, I'd say.
For sure.
So we're gonna sort of bring this in for a landing now. In a second, I just wanted to get your opinion while we still had a little bit of time left. So I've heard from a not very reliable source, but I think that you would be a much better candidate to sort of like give me an opinion on this, is that in May of 2024, there's said to be a Pluto return. Now, I don't know. The only thing I know about Pluto is that when 9/11 happened, it was rumored that there was either a return or a going away or a conjunction with something else. What would you say in terms of, because I know people base, you know, business decisions, you know, JP Morgan was famously apparently had a pocket watch that told them the positions of the stars and the planets, as opposed to time, you know, linear time as we see it. But what would you say about the Pluto return, and sort of like, what would you say to people that are waiting to make a move, you know, when it, in regards to like the planetary alignment?
Yeah, for sure. So I'll say a few things about all of this, and more so actually from my, I guess, just general philosophy or outlook on things. So you'll notice that on my channel, I've never really shown like a natal chart as an example, right? So most astrologers or people who consider themselves astrologers really focused on the dates, really focused on conjunctions and transitions and things of that sort. And I'm way more in the archetypal sort of field of things, where I'm more interested in the mythological aspect of things, the symbolic sort of correspondences between things, how it might relate to our path, our soul's path, things like that. And so specific sort of dates and returns and things like that is not really anything that I spend too much time on. And I'll say that I actually have mixed feelings a little bit with certain types of astrologers who are really hyper-focused on it. Because what I've noticed is a lot of astrologers will spend so much time planning their day or their season or whatever around certain dates and everything else. And my personal thing is that I'm just way more sort of loose than that. And so I don't really spend too much time, you know, looking ahead that way. I try and be as present as possible. And I think that there's something to be said about, you know, some of these readers having a fantastic ability to forecast what's going to happen. But what I've noticed is that a lot of people will forecast things ahead of time and they never review if they actually got it right or not. And so I'm much more of a person that tries to be more present than not. And I think that divination, including astrology and tarot, I think personally, I tend to use it as a way to check in with the present or as a way to check in and reflect on the past. And so when I do tarot readings with people, I will tell people I don't forecast things ahead. So I'm not going to tell you if you should or should not break up with your boyfriend or if you guys are going to stay together or if you're going to get this job or anything of the sort. I'm here to check in right now. I'm here to check in with you right now, or I'm here to check in with you with what just recently happened. Or if you're going through sort of a reflective phase, if you just had a birthday and you want to reflect on, you know, what's happened over the last year or whatever, I'm really, really happy to do that for people. But looking ahead is something that I actually am a little bit weary of. And so fortune telling sort of stuff, forecasting sort of stuff, I see that there's people, once again, where they will put things out there online, make predictions, but never actually go back and talk about, oh, you know what, I was totally wrong about that. Or I got it spot on sort of thing. So that's not so much my cup of tea, but if people do that and they have, you know, sincere opinions about what they think is going to happen, that's fantastic. I'm just probably not the best person to check in with that sort of stuff.
Do you know what? That is actually a much better answer than I was anticipating in retrospect, because, you know, as you said, I didn't really think about it that way. You know, they never do sort of like a end of year review to see how the predictions sort of came out, you know? So that's, yours was a much more sort of like honest and upfront opinion. And that, to me, that's 10 times, you know, what someone could have just blown up my ass, you know? It's just, you know, talking shit, you know? Just some shit to make.
But, for sure. One thing I'll just add to this real quick is that there's a quote that I heard years ago that I find to be true. And I share it with anyone I can when it's relevant. And I believe a monk said this at some point. And so I don't know exactly who to attribute it to, but it's something along the lines of, if you find yourself if you find yourself thinking about the future constantly, you're going to be prone to anxiety. If you find yourself thinking about the past, you're going to be prone to depression. If you find yourself thinking in the present moment, you're prone to peace. And I really find that's true. So I think a lot of people who are hyper-focused on the future, it winds you up, you know? And to me, it's just like, well, why are you avoiding the present right now? You know, I think it's interesting to talk about what may or may not happen, but I've met so many people over the years where that's all they talk about. And so I'm like, wait a second, you're always talking about what's happening next week, next month, next year, you know, what's coming around the corner. But that I think prevents you from checking in and being present right now. You know what I mean? And so to me, this is just an overall sort of philosophy that I try and check myself with, where I try and not get caught up with those sorts of things personally. But I understand, too, that everyone's at a different part of their journey. And so I'm not judgmental or anything like that. Just for me, with myself, I try and be more presently aware, if I can, than forecasting ahead.
You know what? And that is the best way to end a show that I've ever heard. That is really, really great advice. Because, as you said, when you're in the moment and you're present, you know, the clue's in the name, you know, you're present in life, it's almost, you don't miss opportunity as much. You know, if you're, as you said, like, you know, in the past, you're going to be depressed. You know, if you're future, you're going to be anxious about the future. But yeah, just present, just being alive in the moment is it's beautiful. Yeah, it's very, you know, it's super, super beneficial for a human, you know, to have that present awareness. Yeah, it's brilliant. But Mario, this has been so fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on. Just leave the people with where they can find you, and that's pretty much it.
Excellent, man. Yeah, no worries. Symbolicstudies.com is where you can find me. So I have a couple of digital downloads on my store. I offer readings and study sessions. I do lessons with people. I really, really enjoy doing those for people. So people will come out of the woodwork and they'll ask me to review a card with them, one tarot card in a session or something like that, or review their artwork and or review their poetry and see how maybe it can be symbolically more potent. I also do design work if people are interested in that. I've got some prints as well. Check out my YouTube channel. So if anyone goes to it, definitely click on the live tab as well, because I've got a lot of presentations over on that side. But this has been a pleasure, man. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I'm hoping we could do it in the future too, because we've literally scratched the surface, man. There's so much to get into.
Absolutely, dude. I'd be happy to.
Yeah, sweet, Mario. Thank you very much, man. I'm going to go to sleep because it's 1:30 over here. So have a good evening.
Thanks, man. You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Got your number lonely, October 33. I wear it on my soul's back like fair, fair, fair. And I can hear the brass ring, I keep it in the nosebleeds, where you once felt the cold breeze, think it was Halloween. I've got your number lonely, October 33. It's a cold fact, fair, fair, fair. So hold me down like you know how, darling. Hold me now like you feel my plight. I got your number. And in love with you, yeah. I do, do. I got your number lonely, October 33. Your love's my only good thing, like fair, fair, fair. So help me hear the birds sing, I'll help you capture your dream and see it in the prayer. Gonna be a good day, probably 33.
time in the back. I'm still in love with you. Yes, I do. Share. Let me feel your love.
When my roommate comes into the room looking for his car keys, I don't say it yet. And when he gets me off the couch to check underneath the couch cushions, I don't say it yet. No. And then when he says out loud, I wonder where my car keys are, I still don't say it. But then he asks me, do you know where my car keys are? I look at him in his face and I say, have you checked your binos? I've not seen your keys, but since you're asking me,
you better check up that
binos. Well, because I'm not serious, I don't think it's up inside your big brown business. But a funnier thing to say to someone who's lost their shit and is stressed out visibly, when I see the best man start to sweat, I don't say it yet. When I see that little ring bearer cut getting yelled at by his mum, oh, I still don't say it. When I see the groom asking the vicar if they can wait just another 15 minutes, I do not say it. And when the father of the bride starts organising an ad hoc emu bob of the courtyard area, I want to, but I do not say it. It's the 11th hour with 300 congregants under God's roof. The vicar approaches the mic and suddenly all of the chatter goes mute. He says that they've misplaced the rings. Could anyone possibly know where they are? I know it's my time and all heads turn as I stand and say, vicar, have you checked your vitals?
I lost my loan.
Have you checked up your vehicle?
I'm losing my patience.
Check your earbuds.
Where is your class?
Think he's stuck up your ass.
I just lost my grandma.
Oh my god, I'm so sorry.
Are you capable of not saying she's up my asshole?
Of course, my condolences.
I'm not looking for a silly joke right now.
Yeah, yeah. What are you looking for? Honestly, just like a shoulder to
cry. Have you checked your butthole?